I love when the DJ spins this one. That's a good song. We've got Jeff Cabaceres from the Niskanen Center. He's the VP of Political Studies. Smartest dude in the room. And I want to talk about, you know, what's the game plan here? I don't know if, you know, because I've never stepped inside of a, you know, a think tank or a policy center. Like, do you guys like war game this stuff? It's like, okay, well, if this happens, this happens. Does anyone run through some of those scenarios?
Let me first of all hasten to add that I would never describe myself as the smartest guy in the room.
You said that last time. I'm sticking with that.
it can only bring disaster upon your head.
You're humble.
You know, you mentioned Michael Steele. A lot of what Think Tank World, frankly, is about is connecting people who have different perspectives and trying to hear them out. Although it's a think tank by label, in a lot of ways, it's a listening tank. And you're trying to hear people from a lot of different perspectives and then think about what hasn't been said or hasn't been noticed enough in the popular discourse, in the political discourse. And, you know, the Niskanen Center, you were very kind to give a description of what it is. You know, it's always been hard to describe. It's not exactly a center-right think tank. It's not exactly a post-libertarian think tank, but it has elements of those in its DNA. But I would largely say that we are engaged in trying to talk to members on both sides of the aisle in Congress and find the people who are serious about addressing a particular issue and then do what we can to help them out, whether they're Republican or Democrat. So, again, I'm not sure that bipartisan is the right word for what we do, but we are trying to make things better in our own way. But I think, you know, there's also a place in think tank world for thinking big about, like I said, the problems that are facing all of society and how we got to where we are. And that's why I'm very grateful as a historian, you know, from a largely academic background, to be able to hold down a job here. Because I do talk to a lot of people who are trying to think, how did the Republican Party change so much from what it was in the 1950s under Eisenhower, or even in the 1980s, 90s under Reagan and Bush, or even in the 2000s under George W. Bush, to Donald Trump's populism? How did this happen? And, you know, I don't think we have answers, and I don't know that we have, you know, the simple solution to how we get out of this, but we at least have angles on what has happened.
Yeah, that's why I love the Niskanen Center, because it's kind of like my motto here for this show is it's not left versus right, it's right versus wrong. And I think what's cool about what you guys do is that that's what you do. You find the people that want to do the most good and you help them do it, which is an admirable thing. And we do need more of that. But, you know, what are people seeing is like, what's going to happen in 2 years? I mean, we don't necessarily know, you know, what policies or all of that, but like, is there a Republican Party in the future? If there is, what happens to the people that did want, you know, Tom Tillis, he did want to work, he did want to do something, but now, you know, is going into that populism and the Trumpism and because it plays well?
Well, you know, for complicated reasons, America seems to be stuck with a two-party system. Even though, you know, in any other system, we would probably have multiple parties contending because, you know, the moderate Republicans I wrote about always had a fairly uneasy coexistence with more conservative Republicans. and Trump's populism is something different even from that. And if you go back in American history to look for predecessors to Trump, yes, you find it in the Republican Party in figures like Joe McCarthy, but also in the Democratic Party in figures like George Wallace. And populism has a long and fairly bipartisan strain in American history going all the way back to the 19th century. And, you know, American society, even when it has had periods of apparent consensus, has always had a lot of stress points within it. We're a very divided society, partly because we're just such a big society. But, you know, I think what we have seen in recent times is that Republicans who didn't like Trump nonetheless knew that he really had a hold on a large part of the Republican base, and he could walk at any moment. And the fear of letting Trump walk away with his supporters and maybe try to start a third party is what kept Republicans on board even after January 6th and ultimately allowed him to regain power. And, you know, the Democrats have their own problems with their more extreme factions and their seeming inability to repudiate them and move toward a more popular position. I saw actually that Quinnipiac came out with a poll showing that Democrats are more unpopular now with a 57% disapproval rating than they have been at any point since that poll started being taken back in the early 2000s. So, you know, they've got a brand problem to overcome, and yet it's very difficult to do that without splitting the party.
Well, because, you know, if you are a conservative, if you are someone who, you know, does dwell in the middle, there is no place for you on the right. There is no, if you are someone that says, I cannot get behind that Trumpism, I cannot do it. Really, it's you're a blue dog or you're nobody, you know.
Well, it's tough, but it's even more complicated than that. So let me actually do a little bit of devil's advocacy.
Yeah,
here,
yeah, okay? I love it.
You know, one of our senior fellows is Jennifer Palka, who I think is just a brilliant person and has written one of the best books about the work of government. It's called Recoding America. I highly recommend to one and all. And, you know, she is a significant person in today's dialogue because she started the U.S. Digital Service, which has now been taken over by Doge. okay. And this is Elon Musk's attempt to do something with the government. What it is isn't quite clear. And, you know, Jen is a reformer, and she understands that government is important, indeed essential, to actually carrying out life for our citizenry. And yet the Democratic Party has been 100% the obstacle of reform. And almost everything that people have proposed to make government more efficient, more effective, to get it online, has been opposed by people from within the bureaucracy and the ranks of the Democratic Party. And in fact, the usual response is to any kind of reform proposal, that's illegal. Is it illegal? No, almost never is. But, you know, people believe it and they're just against change, period. Yeah. And it's tough because when you actually talk about, for example, how the civil service could be much more effective if it had the ability to hire talented people quickly and fire non-performers, that has been an absolute non-starter for Democrats. And, you know, this kind of immovable object invites irresistible force in the form of Trumpism. And, you know, Jen is, I think, taking a wait and see attitude towards Doge. But, you know, it is entirely possible that there could be some positive impact there because Elon Musk is like Trump in lacking any kind of shamelessness. And when people tell him that the thing he wants to do is illegal, he's not going to just take that as an answer. And already he has empowered Doge to do things that the U.S. Digital Service could not do in terms of just getting information from agencies and departments and making them more efficient. And there's a way in which that could turn out to be a positive project. But the problem with Trumpism generally is it takes dynamite to a structure when what you really want to do is renovate it. And, you know, dynamiting the institutions is no more of a solution than absolutely defending them in their decline and dysfunction. So that's the sense, I think, in which we feel like we don't have a party. Both parties are just too set into an anti-establishment or reflexively pro-establishment mindset to actually make any progress.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you're spot on with that. It is interesting that and I think that's one of the frustrations with some of the people that are a little bit on the center side is that Trump has such an opportunity to do so many good things that have been needed to be done for so long. Yeah. He's just such a terrible person and such, you know, the ideas are, and the things that he says is rooted in racism, misogyny, you know, anti-LGBT, like a horrible, a really dark place. But he's someone that could have positive impacts, but it's not really that way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's a real danger on the right of trying to think Trump is the better person than right. He really demonstrates himself to be. But there is no doubt that he has an opportunity. And, you know, we'll see if he makes the most of it. But my suspicion is he will make the worst of it.
So if you are a moderate, are you homeless? Yeah, that's Lincoln Project people or you know, politically homeless. I mean, that's a phrase that's said quite often.
You know, I've been thinking about the whole Never Trump movement. And I think one of the flaws of the Never Trump movement can be self-pity and precisely this belief that we're homeless, you know, we're doomed to scrape in the garbage cans from the comfort of our home out in Fauquier County, Virginia, right?
Yeah.
You know, typically the Never Trump person is someone who is very attuned to a particular segment of the American population, which is educated people, often living in fairly affluent suburbs, who hold down professional and managerial jobs, who have been so turned off by Trump and the Republicans that they've gone over to the Democrats, But they don't necessarily feel at home among the Democrats either. The Democrats have had a lot of their own excesses, which were very evident during the Biden years. So I would actually fault the Never Trump people for not trying to actually do more politically among that segment. You know, my friend Steve Tellis takes things a little bit farther, but he has said that the Never Trump Republicans could have made a lot more of themselves if they had even won one county election in some of these places and tried to have an actual political base from which to operate. And I think that is one answer. But let me also just, you know, this question about homelessness. I don't feel homelessness in the sense that I feel that I can have dialogues with a lot of people on both sides of the aisle here in Washington. And the thing that's concerning increasing numbers of people is the nature of our competition with China. And I suppose you saw the news about DeepSeek.
AI, oh my God,
program that came out, which apparently the Chinese have done something which is as powerful as most of the things coming out of California, and yet is just fractionally
the cost. Like $5 million versus billions and billions.
And you know, Mark Andreessen may be exaggerating when he says that this is like another Sputnik moment, but we might look back on it that way. And I think that what we might see in the Trump administration, if you're looking for a sort of gleam of hope, is that there will be Republicans and Democrats who take the nature of our competition with China sufficiently seriously that they'll actually be willing to team up and make positive progress. It probably isn't going to be the sort of thing that makes big headlines, but it might well be the sort of thing that delivers more support to our scientific and technological operations and actually allows higher education to do what it's best at. And like I said, you might see more covert support for that from both sides of the aisle than you would expect.
I think that would be a wonderful thing. And I think that would also require people that are in the administration to be someone that supports things like higher education and, you know, giving schools the tools that they need to educate people in the way that they, that can make them successful. And, you know, that would be something that I think we would need as well.
Yeah. But, you know, will we find moderation is the question.
Right.
And, you know, it seems that the dynamic is that the left comes out with the 1619 Project, which says that the whole American experience and all of our ideals are rooted in slavery.
Yeah.
And that's not something that the American people likes. And then the Republicans come out with the 1776 Commission, which essentially whitewashes American history and said, you know, that everyone in American history has always been good and noble, except for those evil Democrats and progressives who brought in bureaucracy and taxation. And people just, they want something somewhere in the middle of that, and they're not getting what they're looking for.
So that's kind of the question that I have, you know, of you is if there is someone that is in the middle, if there is someone that, you know, that's going to be running for Senate or state office or whatever, and they say, you know, I don't believe that the government should overtax people. I believe that people should have their freedoms enshrined in the Constitution. Those are unalienable. Those are ours, and that is uniquely American. And I believe that we should do what's right and fight for what is right and work with people. What side is that? They would run as an R or a D. I think I know the answer to that. Because
because
of my, you know, my experience with the Republican Party, that's where I was. And when I saw someone that was uniquely dangerous and uniquely positioned and uniquely not giving a flying F about where we are, you had to align with that guy or you're not in the party.
You know, I think things are tougher for the Republicans. The kind of person you're describing who actually does want to speak to the whole population and solve problems is going to have to face the difficulty that if they enter as a Republican, they're more or less obligated to acknowledge that Trump was the real winner of the 2020 election. So they have to bend the knee to a lie. And that is something that is almost immediately disqualifying for someone who
100%.
Wants to actually be a moral, honest operative in search of truth and progress. So that's a problem.
We have 10 seconds left. So
You know, the problem that we face on both sides is that to win the nomination, you have to get through the primary, and the primary only attacks a relatively small audience of the most committed ideologues.
Right.
And that's tough for both parties.
Right. Jeff Cabaservice, we could keep this going for another hour. I thank you so very much for your time. I know it's very precious, and thank you for your friendship, and I appreciate everything. We'll see you back.
Always to talk to you, Mark.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
We'll see you back on the Rational Revolution right after this.